This hour's top stories. Political tensions escalate in the U.S. as Joe Biden says his transition to presidency is underway despite Trump's refusal to concede. The official in charge of voter fraud investigations at the U.S. Justice Department resigns after Attorney General William Barr authorized federal prosecutors to probe possible election fraud. And Italy reports nearly 600 coronavirus fatalities, its highest daily death toll since mid-April. Welcome to the program. Our top story, U.S. President-elect by media count, Joe Biden says, it does not matter whether or not President Donald Trump accepts his victory in the race for the White House. Take a listen.
And so I'm confident that the fact that they're not willing to acknowledge we won at this point is not of much consequence in our planning and what we're able to do between now and January 20th.
Biden noted that he and his team have already begun the transition process, adding that nothing is going to stop that. He also called Trump's refusal to concede defeat an embarrassment, which will not help his legacy. The former vice president's remarks come as the Trump administration continues to refuse Biden's victory. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has ruled out the possibility of a transition of Donald Trump's administration to a new one.
Is the State Department currently preparing to engage with the Biden transition team? And if not, at what point does a delay hamper a smooth transition or pose a risk to national security?
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes. When the process is complete, there'll be electors selected. There's a process. The Constitution lays it out pretty clearly.
Pompeo said the State Department will do whatever necessary to make sure the U.S. government will continue to perform its national security functions as it goes forward. Earlier, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell voiced support for Trump to pursue the case of election fraud in courts. Trump's campaign has unveiled several lawsuits against election officials in Pennsylvania, following similar suits in some other states. The campaign alleges that Pennsylvania's mail-in voting system lacked the transparency the in-person balloting had. Trump has said he lost the election to his Democratic rival Joe Biden due to fraud, but has offered no evidence to support his claim. Political commentator Mr. Frank Emspach says there could be social unrest in the U.S. if Donald Trump continues to claim he won the presidential election.
Generally speaking, over the last 20 years or so, when you had a recount, and let's say there's 20,000 difference or something like that, usually the recount only results in a 400 or 500 vote switch. So right now, as far as anybody knows, from the legal perspective, there's nothing on the table that would cause anybody to say the election is somehow invalid. What's happening, I think, is a very dangerous situation. Because by refusing to acknowledge that there has been an election, that he has lost, and they keep talking about a smooth transition to the second Trump administration or whatever Secretary of State Pompeo said, that sets in motion potentially a situation of great social unrest. And I hope that's not what is going to happen here.
A top official from the U.S. Justice Department steps down in protest after Attorney General William Barr authorized federal prosecutors to probe possible election fraud. Richard Pilger was the director of the Elections Crimes Branch in the Justice Department. In his resignation letter, Pilger said Barr was revoking the 40-year-old policy of non-interference for ballot fraud investigations prior to elections being certified. Now, on Monday, the U.S. Attorney General issued a memo allowing prosecutors to launch probes into what he called voting and vote tabulation irregularities. Prosecutors normally require permission from the Justice Department's Elections Crimes Branch to investigate possible vote fraud before elections are certified. Now, President Donald Trump has claimed, without providing any evidence, that his Democratic rival, Joe Biden, is projected the winner due to fraud. Ronnie Corvello joined us earlier with the latest on U.S. President Donald Trump's legal challenges against the 2020 election results.
Some of the Trump followers who are saying in the media that they do support whatever actions Donald Trump are taking in order to cancel some of the votes. So, okay, for those supporters saying that, but what I have is a position from different federal judges. The Pennsylvania, in the case of Pennsylvania, the federal judge dismissed the request to stop counting. In Michigan, the judge rejected another lawsuit because they had no evidence. In Arizona, was another rejection. Trump's team wants to cancel some votes because some people use a different kind of Sharpies. In Georgia, the federal judge also rejected Trump's request because Trump's team wants to cancel some of the votes that was cast after 7 p.m. In Nevada, the federal judge also rejected a lawsuit there because Donald Trump wants to stop the county, the use of a machine, a verification machine.
The United States has imposed fresh sanctions on a number of individuals and firms over their alleged link to a U.S. blacklisted Iranian firm. The U.S. Treasury Department said the restrictions target four people and six companies based in Iran, Hong Kong, Brunei, and China. They are accused of facilitating the procurement of sensitive goods, including U.S.-made electronic components for Iran communication industries. The U.S. Treasury says the company produces military communication systems, avionics, and missile launchers, among other items. The move is the latest by the Donald Trump administration to ratchet up pressure on Iran. Tehran says Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign amounts to economic terrorism. Political commentator Mr. Jim Dean says President Donald Trump is trying to create hurdles for a Biden presidency in terms of its Iran policy.
Anticipated this, and Trump and his campaign telegraphed this already in the news, that he was going to spend the whole next month doing a whole range of sanctions on Iran. He was going to be very busy during what should be a transitional period, where he's handing things over and laying out it, going into the background. He's wanting to, as part of his bitterness and losing the election, and then also while these court tests are going on until that silliness is over, he's going to, as part of his disrupting the Trump administration getting started up. So then he's also going to create Biden in, and by some of these sanctions, which I'm not sure of the legality, whether it's something that Biden can just reverse some of these new sanctions if he does. But I think another one of the reasons Trump's doing this is so that if Biden does reverse these sanctions when he takes office, the Republicans can then claim that he's going weak on Iran and that he's not going to be tough enough like Trump said he was.
Iran says the so-called flood of new sanctions against the oil industry systems from Washington's grudge against Tehran, Salman Kujuri reports.
Iran's oil minister says the latest wave of sanctions imposed by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump, which targets the Islamic Republic's oil sector, has no practical effect and stems from Washington's grudge against Tehran. The U.S. administration imposed a fresh round of sanctions on a number of Iranian individuals and entities affiliated with the Islamic Republic's oil sector, including Minister of Petroleum Bijan Zangane. In its statement, the U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions targeted eight officials and entities, as well as the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, and the National Iranian Tanker Company, NITC. The companies of Madanipur, Mobin Holding Limited, and Oman Fuel Trading LTD were also blacklisted.
If they have any proof that I'm working with IRGC, they need to show me. If they have any proof that I'm working with the PDVSA of Venezuela, they need to show me. If they are respecting their rule and their court, they need to respect and give back the property.
Incoming reports show that Trump plans to impose a flood of new sanctions against Iran, but the Iranian oil minister Zangane says they have sanctioned whatever exists, and that the only thing left for Washington to sanction is probably the services sector.
We have plenty of the oil resources, and we want to work with all the people of the world. We are friends with all the people in the region, and they are helping us, and they are working with us. And if America want to sanction, it doesn't change anything at all.
Tehran believes the era of unilateralism is over in the world, and that Iran's oil industry will not be hamstrung. Robert O'Brien, U.S. President Donald Trump's national security advisor, has recently said that the U.S. has imposed so many sanctions on Iran that, quote, there is very little left for us to do, unquote. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister says Washington needs to kick the habit of sanctions because it gets nowhere. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
Welcome back. The coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc across Europe, with the number of COVID-19 deaths surpassing the grim milestone of 300,000 in the continent. Italy reports its highest daily death toll since April the 14th, registering nearly 600 coronavirus fatalities in a single day. The Italian Health Ministry also reported over 35,000 new cases of the virus. The disease has now claimed a total of more than 42,000 lives out of nearly 1 million confirmed cases in the country. The UK also reported 530 new daily COVID-19 deaths, its highest toll since mid-May. So far, over 1.2 million confirmed cases of the virus have been reported in the country. In Poland, officials say the country should be shut down if new cases surpass 30,000. The European Commission chief says Brussels-Washington relations that were strained under U.S. President Donald Trump will not be restored just because of, quote, one election. Addressing EU ambassadors in a video link conference, Ursula von der Leyen said the U.S. has changed over the previous years and things could not go back to the way they were before. She said although divisions can be bridged, some shifts in priorities and perceptions run much deeper than one politician or administration. However, von der Leyen called for a new transatlantic alliance in areas such as climate change and the digital economy under President-elect Joe Biden.
Our alliance is based on shared values and history, on a common belief in working together to build a stronger, more peaceful, and more prosperous world. And these goals will always endure. But in a changing global landscape, I believe it is time for a new transatlantic agenda fit for today's world.
Also addressing the ambassadors was EU Council President Charles Michel. He also said that as the EU should remain vigilant not to react with euphoria to the change in U.S. administration. Michel warned the EU and U.S. interests would not always converge in a systematic way. EU-U.S. relations have suffered markedly under Trump over issues such as tariffs and the U.S. withdrawal from international accords and organizations. EU officials have been quick to congratulate Biden, hoping that he would represent an improvement in ties. Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Russia have signed an agreement to end military conflict over the disputed enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. Thousands have died and roughly 100,000 have been displaced. Some say the deal is a betrayal.
After the deal was announced, people flooded the streets of Azerbaijan's capital to celebrate the end of the conflict and the gains made. Via the deal, Baku will hold on to areas of Nagorno-Karabakh that it took during the conflict, including the enclave's second city of Shusha, and between now and December 1st, ethnic Armenian forces must give up control of a slew of other territories.
I bow down in front of the families and mothers of the martyrs. We rejoice today at the cost of their children's blood. I bow down to them. That's all I can say.
However, over in Armenia, there is no jubilation. Protesters have stormed the parliament, branding the prime minister a traitor and calling for him to resign. Although the leadership of the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave says 1,200 of its defense forces have been killed and the main city of Stepanakert would have been lost within days if the fighting had continued, some say victory was possible. Armenia's prime minister says the deal was unbelievably painful but unavoidable.
Under the circumstances, making a different decision wasn't possible. I plan to give more details why it wasn't and tell everyone the reason behind last month's events. I can't do it right now for one simple reason, because we are in the process of stopping military action right now, and if I say something, I might endanger people.
Keeping a close eye on the conflict throughout, Iran, which shares borders with the disputed region, called for a peaceful settlement of the conflict that respected international law and the territorial integrity of Azerbaijan. Russian President Vladimir Putin says the arrangement will pave the way for a lasting political settlement. For now, the battle is over, and thousands of people will now be left to pick up the pieces of their shattered lives. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The 143rd birth anniversary of great Muslim philosopher and poet Dr. Allama Muhammad Iqbal has been marked across Pakistan. Iqbal's philosophical literature is considered as a leading source for unity among Muslims all over the world, regardless of their language, culture, and sect. Javed Rana is in Islamabad.
A guard of honor at the shrine of Dr. Allama Muhammad Iqbal in the eastern city of Lahore. It was 143rd birth anniversary of Iqbal, the ideological mind behind the creation of Pakistan in 1947. Iqbal, who died in 1938, extensively wrote against Western imperialism over Islamic world in the 20th century, when most of the Muslim world was under British, French, and other Western colonial powers. Iqbal's poetry and philosophy evoked a passion of Islamic nationhood among Muslims of all colors, creed, and sects living anywhere in the world. Prime Minister Imran Khan has vowed to seek guidance from Iqbal's philosophy in transforming Pakistan into an Islamic welfare country on the pattern of Islamic State of Medina, established by the last prophet of Islam over 14 centuries ago. Muhammad Iqbal has been the common ideological heritage not only in Pakistan but also in Turkey, Afghanistan, Iran, Central Asia, and beyond. Many Iranians proudly bracket Iqbal with the legendary Persian poets and sought inspiration from his poetic literature for 1979's revolution. Iran's leader Ali Khamenei authored a book, Iqbal, the poetic philosopher of Islamic resurgence. He describes Iqbal as a poetic genius. Through poetry and philosophical literature, Dr. Iqbal reminded the Muslim of the fact that their Islamic system of governance is a far more superior than that of Western secular democracy, and that is why he metaphorically described the Western democracy as shallow.
Democracy was an instrument which was used for the disintegration of the Muslim cultures and society. One thing and the other thing, and he also said that Western culture and society and civilization, in a nutshell, will commit suicide under the burdens of its own values and customs. And what are those values? Those values are blasphemy of prophets. And those values are nudity, and those values are huge number of childbirths out of wedlocks.
Iqbal's literature from Urdu, Persian, and English have been translated in more than 60 languages in the world to understand his philosophy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
And that's it with international news.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Capture a variety of opinions in the 2020 U.S. presidential race. Reuters news agency spoke to 42 women in 12 states. Arizona, Florida, Nevada, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Ohio, Nebraska, and Indiana. But voters swung for and against Donald Trump. Some once stalwart Republicans told Reuters they had, for the first time, crossed party lines to vote for Joe Biden. Some were young, first-time voters, selecting Biden only because they saw the alternative as far worse. Others, whether Republican or Democrat, said they had never liked or voted for Trump. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Michael Rosenberg, Gabriella Porter, PJ Hofstadter, Mimi Dwyer, and Chris Kahn. The piece is titled, I Just Couldn't Be Silent, How American Women Decided 2020 Presidential Race. The article has been taken from the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more. Grace Badala's 82-year-old mother had been a fan of President Donald Trump since his days hosting the reality TV show The Apprentice. She enthusiastically voted for Trump in 2016. But in the first weeks of the coronavirus pandemic, as the two watched daily White House briefings, Badala's mom, Grace Weber, voiced her first doubts. Badala, a 48-year-old home care nurse, recalled Weber asking, why isn't he listening to the medical experts? Weeks later, Weber landed in the hospital with a gastrointestinal bleed. She soon contracted the coronavirus, spending nearly a month on a ventilator. In May, Badala said goodbye to Weber over FaceTime, clutching her mother's rosary beads. Badala, who lives in a suburb of Scranton, Pennsylvania, had been a Republican all her life. But she concluded, Trump lacked the integrity and trustworthiness and responsibility she was raised to value, and she wanted him out. She became a prominent booster of Trump's Democratic rival, even agreeing to appear in an online advertisement for former Vice President Joe Biden's campaign. She said, I just couldn't be silent on this one. I let my mom's voice be heard. Women appear to have been crucial in delivering the U.S. presidency to Joe Biden. They were at the forefront of the highest U.S. voter turnout in at least a century, casting ballots at higher rates than men. And according to exit polls from Edison Research Firm, more than half of female voters, 56%, chose the former vice president compared to 48% of men. Media outlets called the race for Joe Biden on Saturday after he pulled ahead decisively in Pennsylvania. It wasn't just women who carried Biden. Donald Trump lost ground among male voters in 2020 compared to 2016, but key to Joe Biden's success were his gains among white college-educated women in battleground states, women like Vidala, who turned out in high numbers than for Trump's Democratic rival Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. African-American women, and to a lesser degree, Latinas, supported Biden's bid for the White House over Trump by white majorities nationally, and more so than African-American and Latino men. Trump has not conceded the race, even as Biden's lead in the vote tally rises. Recounts appear likely in states where the margin is narrow, but Donald Trump would need to overturn the results in at least 3 states to prevail. Trump's court battles, too, are widely seen as unlikely to change the outcome of the elections. Trump's difficulties in appealing to women voters long predate this election and the pandemic. Accusations of sexual harassment and assault have dogged him for years. The day after Trump's 2017 inauguration, hundreds of thousands of people protested his election in a women's march in Washington, D.C. and other cities around the country. Still, Donald Trump held strong with one female demographic across both elections, white women without college degrees, including some of Vidala's relatives in Pennsylvania. To capture a variety of opinions in the 2020 race, Reuters news agency spoke to 42 women in 12 states. Arizona, Florida, Nevada, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, Ohio, Nebraska, and Indiana, where voters swung for and against Donald Trump. Some once stalwart Republicans told Reuters they had, for the first time, crossed party lines to vote for Joe Biden. Some were young, first-time voters, selecting Biden only because they saw the alternative as far worse. Others, whether Republican or Democrat, said they had never liked or voted for Donald Trump. Among Trump supporters, some women were fans whose votes and organizing on his behalf helped him to outperform expectations in several states. Regardless of their differences, many women threw themselves into political activism for the first time during this presidential campaign. Biden backers said in interviews that they were motivated by back-to-back crises of the past year, including the coronavirus pandemic, economic turmoil, and widespread protests against racism and police brutality. Paula McCabe, a 44-year-old of Williamsport, Pennsylvania, who lost her job at a coffee shop equipment manufacturer during the pandemic, said she was more motivated than ever before to vote this year. Paula McCabe, who voted for Joe Biden, said, "I've never been through an election that literally meant the entire country was going to crash and burn or finally thrive." She added, "This to me is probably the most important vote I've ever been alive for." Women in the United States have in many ways bore the brunt of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, they have left the labor force at starkly higher rates than men as they juggle homeschooling duties and childcare. According to a Washington, D.C.-based Center for Economic and Policy Research, those able to stay employed are more often working frontline jobs, especially in medicine or social services. Reuters polling before the election showed COVID-19, the disease that has killed more than 245,000 Americans this year, was a dominant issue for all voters, but more so for women. The Edison voter exit poll said 52% of women voters said that Joe Biden would be better at dealing with the coronavirus, compared with 44% who thought the same of Trump. But views on how much the coronavirus mattered to their vote were starkly divided along political lines. 24% of Biden voters said it was the issue that mattered most to them, compared to 5% of Donald Trump supporters. The fear of COVID-19 was ever present for Denise Calloway in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, after she lost several friends to the disease. But her primary motivation for voting was different: the chance to elect Kamala Harris as the first female, an African-American, vice president. Denise Calloway, 64-year-old, said she cried when Biden announced Harris as his running mate. Calloway, a retired public relations executive and consultant, connected with the Biden campaign in Wisconsin through friends at her black sorority. She began canvassing by phone and participated in weekly Zoom prayer circles with other volunteers. Black women, who overwhelmingly vote Democratic and at higher rates than black men, were never big Trump supporters. But Reuters polling showed they grew increasingly critical of the president this year. According to the Edison data, 91% of black women supported Joe Biden, 11 percentage points more than black men. Racial justice issues were important to voters overall. More than half of all voters and 87% of Biden voters said they had a favorable view of the Black Lives Matter movement. These activists helped launch national protests after the killing of George Floyd, a black man, by white police officers in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Calloway and her husband raised their son and two daughters, now adults, in Milwaukee County, one of the few that went for Clinton in 2016 when Donald Trump won Wisconsin by under 23,000 votes, in part by citing decades of lost manufacturing jobs. Calloway, the daughter of an auto executive, says Trump has broken promises to bring manufacturing jobs to Rust Belt states. This year, Biden flipped Wisconsin back by almost as narrow a margin as Trump won it in 2016, unless a recount changes the result, which rarely happens in U.S. elections. Nationally, Biden overwhelmingly won the support of young people as a whole, gaining the votes of 62% of 18 to 29-year-olds. Young Latina voter Yasmin Sagastume grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, the youngest of five children born to a mother from Mexico and a father from Guatemala. Now in college, she became politically active whilst in high school. Sagastume said she is not a big Biden fan. She supported the progressive Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries and relates much more to 31-year-old New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez than a white male. Nevertheless, for months she made calls to young Hispanic voters encouraging them to vote. She said, "We're just trying to get Trump out, and that's the only goal." As the campaign progressed, personal collections frayed in a deeply divided country. According to a Reuters Ipsos Election Day poll, a fifth of American voters said they stopped talking to a family member or lost a friend because of the election. Denise Alton, a 46-year-old retired social worker who lives outside Raleigh, North Carolina, said her husband revealed on their anniversary that he had voted for Trump. Having worked with disabled people, she was upset after overhearing her husband's family, also Trump supporters, making fun of Biden's stutter. She says she found Trump's views and treatment towards women degrading. Alton, which was raised in a Republican household, but diverged from her roots when she attended a liberal arts college. She campaigned for Barack Obama. But never before has she been as passionate about politics. She had her Trump-supporting husband drive her around the country to put out Biden-Harris signs and, with her daughter, wrote postcards to encourage people to vote. More than half of college-educated white women in North Carolina, like Alton, voted for Joe Biden, whilst their support for Donald Trump dropped 8 percentage points compared to 2016. Even among rural women, one of Trump's strongest base of support in 2016, the president saw his margins shrink. According to Edison exit polling, nationally, Donald Trump won 54% of the U.S. rural vote, 7 points less than in 2016. Slightly more than half of rural women supported Joe Biden this year. One was Rebecca Seidel, a 37-year-old who runs a small sustainable dairy farm in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, with her husband. For most of her life, her views viewed closely to her Republican father's. But after Donald Trump was elected in 2016, Seidel left the Republican Party and registered as a Democrat, partly because of what she saw as rising racism and Trump's protectionist trade policies. In the 2020 campaign, Seidel's concerns kicked into high gear when she and her entire family contracted COVID-19. She said her mom was hospitalized for 4 days, and Seidel lost her sense of smell and taste, crimping her plans to open a small cheese-making business. At a local farm supply store recently, she noticed a group of men chatting as they bagged up animal feed. None wore face masks, a sign to her that some in her community weren't taking the pandemic seriously enough. Seidel said, "It's become a political statement," adding, "Some people believe if you wear a face mask, you're not for Trump." Donald Trump has long commanded a strong following among white evangelical Christian voters, and according to Edison, 76% of them voted for him this time around. But that is 4 percentage points less than in 2016. Trump also lost Hyla Winters' vote. Winters, a 71-year-old, a devout evangelical and regular attendee of a Las Vegas megachurch, voted for Donald Trump in 2016, but over time she became disheartened by his attacks on the purported enemies. Winters, a retired college administrator, said, "His behavior is appalling. It's embarrassing. While she has not embraced the entire Democratic platform, she supported Joe Biden in presidential elections. She had been somewhat supportive of Trump's plan to build a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, but was horrified by his zero-tolerance policy in which young migrant children were forcibly separated from their parents. She went online to find ways to get more involved politically, eventually finding a YouTube video on how to create a blog. In February, she started one, naming it NotTrump.net. As the protests against police brutality broke out, she reached out to a black friend to learn more about what it's meant to have white privilege. Winters said, "She gave me some homework, including some books and online resources. During early voting, she volunteered for 7 days at a voting site to answer questions and direct people to open booths. However, she got some bad news on Wednesday, 4th of November. She tested positive for COVID-19. She had been wearing a face mask under an outdoor tent, but she said some voters had no face coverings. Her husband, a Trump supporter, also tested positive. Whilst neither have serious symptoms, they now have to quarantine together. Hyla Winters said maybe they will have more time to resolve some of their political differences.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and here is a brief but bright statement on the realities of life expressed by Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. O people, you should know that everyone who walks on the surface of this earth will eventually go beneath it.
Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمع.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام إذا هبت أمرا فقع فيه فإن شدة توقيه أعظم مما تخاف منه.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "When you are afraid of something, dive straight into it, because the intensity of abstaining from it is greater than what you are afraid of." ¶¶
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the great lessons which we learn from Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, is for us to be able to read Quranic exegesis, or as it is known as Quranic tafsir. So, of course, it is very honorable and very good that we read the Quran, we try to implement the Quran in our lives, we try to read the Arabic part of the Holy Quran. But what is also very important, dear friends, is that we must try to understand what it is that the Arabic is saying. Right? Just reading the Arabic in and of itself is not enough. It is good. It is excellent. It has its own rewards and its own effects. But the next level, which really is the first level, is to read the translation of the Quran. And after the translation of the Quran, it is a good idea to read a tafsir, an exegesis, an exposition, a further explanation of what it is that we find in the Holy Quran. For example, one of the very famous exegesis tafsir of the Holy Quran was done by Allama Tabatabai by the name of Al-Mizan. So this is one of the things which we learn from Imam Ali. He tells us, and we find in the history of the Muslims, in the history of Islam, that in the science of Quranic exegesis, in the Quranic tafsir, none could equal Imam Ali. Now, of course, we have to keep in mind that because Imam Ali learned his knowledge from the Holy Prophet, and the Holy Prophet's knowledge was from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is why they knew the inner meanings of the Holy Quran, as compared to other people who they might have glimpses of the inner meanings of the Holy Quran, but of course, because they are human beings, they don't have a complete understanding of the tafsir, of the explanations, or the in-depth explanations of the Holy Quran, as compared to an infallible imam, as compared to Imam Ali alayhi salam. And so in his book Al-Istiyab, Allama ibn Abdibar has quoted Abdullah ibn Abbas, the son of the uncle of the Holy Prophet, that when we were proved, he says, that when we were proved something regarding the exegesis, the tafsir, the explanation of the Holy Quran from Imam Ali, there remained no need for us to ask anyone else. Subhanallah. So we learn here how first and foremost Imam Ali alayhi salam, because he is connected with divine knowledge, because he is connected with the knowledge of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, who himself was connected with the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we find that Imam Ali's exegesis, his tafsir, his explanation about the Quran was so beautiful and so precise and so perfect that great scholars like even Abdullah ibn Abbas didn't need to ask anyone else about this. And so we too, dear friends, should take a step forwards and read a tafsir of the Quran to try to better understand what it is that Allah the Mighty, the Exalted is saying to us, a profound lesson regarding the tafsir of the Holy Quran brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
Today is to continue that theme about the special fazilat of Amir al-Mu'mineen as far as knowledge is concerned, that he was recipient of ilm al-ladunni, God-gifted knowledge. And we saw various quotations from the experts of Arabic literature as well as many Sunni scholars, including great personalities like Sheikh Muhammad Abdu Dui, Egypt, the Mufti of Egypt. They're all Muslims. Unanimously accord Ali that position of being Imam al-Fusaha and Sayyid al-Bulagha. He is the leader of eloquent speakers and the chief of persuasive orators. And so that status of Amir al-Mu'min is there. Nobody can take that. You know, people come, try to, you know, fight against it, but they are themselves defeated. And it's not Shias who have to do anything. This is the truth that nobody can deny. Even a person like Muawiyah, you know, felt bad when somebody was trying to flattering him by condemning Ali's ability to speak. One of the important collections, of course, is Nahjul Balagha. And this eagerness to preserve the khutbas of Ali is from day one. Nahjul Balagha is the most famous one. And the reason why it has become famous is probably because of the purity of the intention of Sayyid Razi. Because many, many things, you know, people do, they do not realize if the tawfiq of Allah is not there, it doesn't work. And we see that Allah gave tawfiq to Sayyid Razi, that he, like many others, compile, you know, the khutbas and the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen, but this became the most famous one. Even though there were 22 collections with the title of Khutbah Amir al-Mu'mineen before Sayyid Razi.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship. And over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago, at the Mosque Foundation, and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description. It's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi, and I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS, in the first place, because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed